Okay, good afternoon. Welcome to the Christmas lecture, which actually isn't going to be very Christmassy. On the one hand, I'm quite happy because I could never have given justice to that amount of, that many people. I've never had 60 students in the last lecture before Christmas. So, wow. On the other hand, I couldn't have produced as many, I wouldn't have had enough cookies to bring along. So if you came for the cookies, I have to apologize. For various reasons. I know. I can try to blame it on my wife, but I don't think that would be a good idea, right? Maybe some New Year cookies or something like that. I think you deserve something for being here. But I came out of a meeting half an hour ago. We now have a list of people who are going to... We set up a list of people of the applicants for the succession of Professor Stubbs, who you haven't met anymore, but there will be a new professor, hopefully, at the end of the summer semester, next winter semester. And that's kept me really busy, and I know that a couple of you also came to some of these lectures. So no cookies today, I'm afraid. But lots of syntax, which is... Yeah, look at it from a positive point of view. Right, the other thing is that I've just noticed that the recording equipment here doesn't seem to be working properly, or at least it pretends it's already recording, which I'm not sure it is. I'm also recording this on my laptop now, and I hope that I can put this into a way that will work out in the end. It probably won't be online tomorrow morning, but we'll see. There should be at least the audio data and possibly more than that. Right. The assignments are in the process. We're in progress in the sense of correcting it, looking at it, about halfway through. So it's not before Christmas, but it's after Christmas. But you'll get some feedback at the beginning of next year, and I'll also upload the answers that I would have expected and some explanations will be given as well. Right. Okay. Let's start with the lecture proper then. Okay, now syntax. In the last three lectures, what have we done? I've given you an introduction to some of the basic features of grammatical analysis. This included some aspects of what I called the rank scale, word classes, phrases, and clauses. And I asked you to draw some trees, and the point that I made is that the trees are a nice way of showing the hierarchies of sentences, and that this is useful and helpful. For example, for determining ambiguities. Then I introduced something which might have been difficult for some of you, namely these sort of grammatical categories, tense, aspect, mood, voice. And I make the point that these are features of the verb phrase. It's actually something that you can see in the verb group or in the way the verb group is put together. So things like perfect, perfective aspect, progressive, etc., etc. Today we're going to use most of this in some way or other, I think, but more importantly I'd like to look at variation. Variation across different text types, registers, spoken and written language, and also standard and non-standard language. And I will try to see how we can use the categories that we introduced to characterize, for example, spoken language versus written language. I'll finish with a few points on word order, and then, something I'd like to call some final bit of syntactic fun. I'd just like to show you what else is out there. One or two things. just that maybe you find interesting. But the first section is really the most important part of the lecture. Okay, let's look at different text types first. And there can, of course, be formal text types or informal text types. Think about writing a letter. Then, depending on who you write the letter to, whether it's a formal application letter or whether you write, well, to your friend, you probably wouldn't write a letter nowadays. You'd probably write an email or a text message or something like that. But even there, you could easily see how you might use different types of forms, words, of course, but also different types of constructions because of the text type. And we can see correlations between grammatical forms that are used, like, for example, the present tense, and the kind of text types that they are used in typically. Now, of course, the same form can have different meanings. That makes the whole thing a little bit more difficult. For example, if we look at the present tense, he goes to London, this is what we would call the simple present, so it's just the base form, unless, of course, we're talking about third person singular. How is that used, and where is it used? Can we say that this is particularly typical of one particular text type? Well, let's have a look at, or a quick look at, the two major meanings that it has. And in fact, there is a third one that I'd like to quickly mention. And that's the kind of thing that I think you learn at school. What do we use the simple present for? We're looking at a use as referring to, well, the current state in terms of what's going on right now. Or no, not what's going on right now. Sorry, that was wrong. A state, not the progression, sorry. The bus has four wheels. That's the state right now. Or a habitual action, or something that is just generally true. I take the bus to work. I don't have a car. I do this every day. I take the bus to work. Now, of course, you can say, I am taking the bus to work, but then you're not doing this in the same kind of habitual action, typically. Or at least you can use the simple present most like, well, it's the most likely form that you would use. And there's a minor meaning as well, current action. Okay. Here comes the bus. Okay. Actually, you probably more likely find, oh, bus is arriving or approaching or bus is coming. Now, these are different meanings, but I'd like to look at different text types and see whether we can link them up to the use in this case of the present, the simple present. And it's probably no surprise to you that conversation and academic prose, well, academic prose I don't know, but conversation show a preference for this. Have a look at this. What kind of text type is this? And a forehand reply of the first point of the tie break, and here comes Hinman with a etc., etc. What's this? Sports reportage. Something that tends to be a text type where we find a lot of simple presents. Okay. Comes, goes, he is in behind, he's, etc., etc. Which, of course, doesn't mean that you only find the simple present, but it means that there is a statistical a probability, a high probability that if it is a sports commentary, you'll find more present tense, simple present tense uses than other text types. Does the present tense actually mean present time? Does it mean now? Well, we've already seen examples of the use of the present tense for future time. It's open day on Wednesday. It will be open day on Wednesday, but we can say if something is scheduled that it is open day on Wednesday. So clearly the present form, the present tense form, does not necessarily mean that we're talking about something that's happening now. That's also why we use the present tense for future for expressing the future in English. Can we have the present tense referring to, or no, so present, yeah, well, present tense referring to a past time. So yesterday afternoon, Pete comes home from fishing and goes straight to his fridge and takes out a beer and sits down on the sofa, etc. That's past tense. Well, no, it's present tense, but it's past time. This is what people tend to call conversational historical present. It's using the present tense in talking about something that happened in the past, sometimes called historical present tense. So clearly, present tense doesn't necessarily mean now. It can be either the past or the present or the future. The past tense tends to be much more frequent in prose fiction. Once upon a time, there lived a pretty little girl when she was young, etc., etc. Her mother sadly died, and her father remarried, and then was a mean woman. If you put this into the present tense, you can try this. Well, with once upon a time, is obviously we'd have to change this. Now there lives a pretty, or at the moment there lives a pretty girl, pretty little girl. She is, no, you can't even do this, right? It's really difficult. Because, well, these kind of stories, prose fiction, just tends to be written in the past tense. Another use is in reported speech, and of course you learn all of this at school. There is a meeting this week, present tense. He said that there was a meeting this week. So, another typical use of the past tense. Now we've just seen present tense referring to the past. Can we have the past tense referring to the present? Well, in a way, yes. Did you want a cup of tea? Of course you want it now. It may refer back to something that was already asked before, but you could even say this if you've never talked about whether they wanted a cup of tea or not. Now, obviously, this is perhaps less frequent or less obvious, but we also, again, have a mismatch between the actual grammatical form and the time that it would typically refer to. Okay, that was a few points on tense. I'd now like to move over to noun phrases. I'll give you a minute of practice. Can you find all the noun phrases here? Most of you, I suppose, would have found many of those. Renzo and the head director. This is actually called an apposition, but that's more advanced stuff. The newly installed laser light show, the main floor, some very pacey techno, etc., etc. Now, if you look at the structure of these noun phrases, let's have a quick look at the head of the noun phrase itself. So we've got Renzo and director, show and floor. Then you can see that on the one hand there are noun phrases which consist just of one word, but there might be, apart from a determiner, there might be some modification as well. Oh, there is. Okay, head, director, newly installed laser light, main floor, very pacey. So we've got pre-modification via adjuncts, as I introduced in the last few lectures. What kind of text is this? Well, possibly some journalism, some reporting on something that happened in maybe a music magazine or something like this. Now compare these noun phrases to the noun phrases in this text, which you've seen already, if I remember correctly. Again, I'll give you a few seconds doing it again, to see a few noun phrases or to locate them. Quite a few, right? Quite a lot of red text here. And in fact, if you look at the hierarchy within the noun phrase, for example, the director of student services, then you can see that there is more inside this noun phrase, that there are, sort of noun phrases within noun phrases, of course, within a preposition phrase, of student services. Look, this pink stuff here is really quite long. And that's because it contains yet another noun phrase. And this in itself, again, contains another noun phrase. So we've got a noun phrase within a noun phrase within a noun phrase within a noun phrase. Of course, always involving preposition as well. We've got several post-modifiers in this noun phrase. This is very different from the text that we've just seen. In the piece of journalism, we had pre-modification or very simple noun phrases. This is a very formal text. This is a legal text. We have a lot of post-modification. We have a lot of post-modification with preposition phrases, and we've got these in a nested structure. So, report giving details of the circumstances of the alleged offence. Now, all of this is one phrase, remember? We can replace it with a single pronoun. Provide him with it. But there is a lot more inside this noun phrase. So we've got lots of post-modifying elements, relative clauses, preposition phrases, etc. While the first one is much simpler, and if there is any modification, it tends to be pre-modifying. And that's typical of these two text types. Again, of course, it doesn't mean that you never find pre-modification in a legal text, but you are much more likely to find much more post-modification than in journalistic prose. And we can say that these are typical of these texts. Here are some interesting noun phrases for you. London Docklands Developer Kentish Property Group. Or Los Angeles radio talk show host. Or Light Rapid Transit Project team member Mark Haslam. Or IRA assassination target Sir Peter Terry. What do we have here? We've got lots of nouns sort of following each other. Not only nouns, of course, light rapid is not noun, it's not a sequence of nouns, but basically we tend to have, in these examples, we've got one noun following each other and the whole thing is one noun phrase. What text type is this typical of? Newspapers. Why? Because newspapers need space, or actually don't have much space. So you need to be dense in your language. You can, of course, also talk about Sir Peter Terry, who was once a target of an IRA assassination, or of an assassination that was carried out by the IRA. But by the time you've described all of this, you've wasted half of the space that you have for the article. So there's been a tendency in recent years, recent decades, for newspaper language to become more dense. One of the processes, well, some people call this densification. And again, it's a feature of grammatical structure that seems to be typical of one particular text type. This can be confirmed by looking at a large corpus of 100 million words, the British National Corpus, which you've already encountered earlier on, which you encountered in week one. What I did here was simply look for sequences of six nouns. I looked for noun, followed by noun, followed by noun, followed by noun, etc., six times. And I look at how often in different major text types, namely newspapers, academic prose, fiction, and then SCG stands for spoken context governed, which is sort of the formal part or the context governed part of the spoken part of the corpus. Tends to be more formal. And if we compare frequencies, then very clearly this is a newspaper phenomenon. In fiction, I mean in a book, in a novel, you wouldn't expect this kind of sequencing of nouns. It's no surprise that in the spoken context government text there is, or in the spoken text, this is slightly more because of the context, business meetings, etc., where perhaps statements are being referred to or titles are being referred to of the kind that you've seen in the newspapers. But this is really a massive difference. It's a text type specific feature. Okay. Those were some differences between text types, and now I'd like to move over to a major distinction in language, and that's between spoken and written language. And again, I'd like to look at some of the features in the context of grammar. For this, I actually, and this is because I merged two lectures into one, I'm actually going to move over to a completely different style. Sorry for shocking you with some more pink, but the content, and not pink, this isn't pink, I'm a man, I'm not supposed to know much about colour, right? But we can, you'll hear more about that next semester, but not from me. Language and gender, okay. What would you call this? Okay, let's leave that, okay. Anyway, you've seen this text before, and you've already seen the text on the following slide too. This was the description of the rainbow, and in fact this is a description in a novel by D.H. Lawrence, and I already made the point that this is very different in lexis, but also in terms of grammar, from the description of the rainbow that we saw in the spoken extract. Now, can you just spend a few seconds to look at this spoken extract and highlight anything, or write down, or discuss with your neighbor anything that you consider to be particularly spoken, that you wouldn't expect to see written down in a novel or in any other type of written text?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the arrow?
The yes, or the or what? I mean, it depends on how you transcribe it. But it's the, well, what is it? It's a filled pause, as it's referred to in linguistics. So it's not silence, but there is something yeah, it tends to happen in contexts where the speaker either doesn't quite know what to say next, or where it's perhaps a little bit more difficult to find the right word, the exact right word, or where just it might also be a strategy to keep the floor in the sense that the other person knows that something else is still happening. Nothing that you would see in a written text. I saw a hand up go there, yes? For ah, yes, okay. Far away ah, seven colors. Depends on, I mean, is it the same thing or not? Possibly something different, but yeah. Right, just a series. We've got a disfluency, we've got repetition. Mm-hmm. Now that's not repetition because of content, but it's repetition because we are, as speakers, producing text sort of on the fly. We need to produce this and think about it. Right, now I've just produced one. While speaking, even though I more or less know what I want to say, I still produce these kind of things, and I might sometimes say, two things before I finish my sentence. Yeah, and quite clearly, the speaker needed to think a bit more. There was another hand somewhere. Yes? Yes, if you see what I mean, or also, or something like that. Right? These are kind of difficult to say what it is. Notice, by the way, that I say it's kind of difficult to say what it is. Which again seems to be something spoken or speech-like. It's difficult, but why did I say it's kind of difficult? Because maybe difficult is not 100% the right word, but it's just the best that I can find in the current situation, and therefore I hedge slightly by saying, well, I'm aware it's not 100% the best word, but if I wait till I find the best word, then you probably start speaking, and I don't want that. Okay. So, or something like that, it's like, it's also vague. And then if you see what I mean, it's got to do with interaction, of course. What about this? Which they seem to be. This seems to have two subjects. Well, in a way, one's in the relative marker, but then again, in the subordinate clause, we've got the pronoun functioning as subject. Again, this is a disfluency, or it's something where something that doesn't work out according to normal grammar rules. We've got well, so-called discourse markers. There's quite a lot there. Also, I guess. This isn't guessing in the sense of how many people are here. Well, I guess around 65 is not this kind of guessing, but it's expressing something different. It's expressing something about the attitude of the speaker towards what they're saying. We also very commonly seem to chunk things in spoken language in fairly simple ways. For example, we might write something like this: Old Man MacArthur. He was a wee chap, oh, very small, and, oh, a beard, and he was pretty stooped. This is one piece of information at a time. Had a beard, was small, walked in a stooped way, etc. Could have been done very differently. This is not the same sentence, but completely different way of producing this kind of information. A man who turned into human torch 10 days ago after snoozing in his locked car while smoking his pipe has died in hospital. Where are you where are you likely to find this kind of sentence? Again, probably a newspaper. What's the structure of this sentence? Well, on one level, very simple. It's not a simple sentence because it's got a subordinate clause, so it's a complex one. But basically, this is one single noun phrase. A man has died in hospital. What kind of man? Well, who turned into human torch 10 days ago after snoozing in his locked car while smoking his pipe? Lots of information put into one grammatical unit, which contains subunits, of course, but still. While if you compare this to these up here, one piece of information per unit. So clearly very different. And why this difference? Well, this perhaps, or I'm quite convinced, has to do with the way we produce language when we speak and it's not premeditated. There are limits to our cognitive abilities and they are expressed in the way we structure information. You can't, well, some people can, we can train this, you can't really produce this kind of thing, well, you can produce it once, but you can't produce a text that is very long with this kind of complexity, simply because we tend not to do this in spoken language. Well, not because, but because it's difficult to do. So, spoken and written language varies. We've seen this, they're quite dramatic differences. Words, the different types of words. If you compare the rainbow descriptions, then there's a completely different type of vocabulary. The density is different. Density referring to how tightly the information is packaged. And then, of course, also the syntax. And this has to do, as I said, with the cognitive abilities that we have in producing what could be called online language doing online language production. Let's have another look at spoken versus written grammar. And in fact, there are different views on spoken grammar. Remember that I told you in the first lecture that written language is interpreted to be superior by many people, okay, because it's written down. But of course, spoken language is the thing that most of us produce all the time. So one of the questions is whether this is the same thing, whether we're talking about the same kind of organization, or whether perhaps, and this is a controversial statement, spoken English has no grammar at all. It is grammatically inchoate, meaning that it's sort of only starting to begin to form rules. It's nothing like the well-structured text that we have in written language. That's one view. Or some people feel that that spoken English does not have a special grammar. It's just the same as written. Or then there are some who say that it does have a special grammar. It has its own rules, its own principles, categories, which are different from those of written English. So, no grammar is the same or different grammar. Well, let's have a look at what we can find in favor or against these views. This is an actual transcription of some part of a conversation, and I think you can agree with me that this tends to... Well, this is support of the first claim. No, do you know where the fire station is not the one that white. Okay, chaos, mess, no grammar, nonsense. Mm-hmm. Now I'm quite sure if you listen to this, it would make much much more sense to you in the larger context. But still, we would find it difficult to put grammatical structure into this in the same way as we've done so far. But this is actually fairly rarely the case. You're much more likely to find spoken language that functions as follows. The trouble is, if you're the only one in the house, he follows you and you're looking for him, and every time you're moving around, he's moving around behind you. So you can't find him. I wonder where the hell he's gone. I mean, he was immediately behind me, etc. Now there are some things which are slightly odd. Where the hell's he gone? Well, that's actually not odd, because where the hell has he gone? So that's perfectly fine. There are some repetitions, but basically this is normal grammar, in the sense that there is nothing that violates the rules. So there might be situations where things look totally chaotic, but this, given that this is the norm, that you find sentences that fully conform to the rules of standard English, I would say that it's simply wrong to say that spoken English has no grammar at all. This is a typical layperson's view. But it's not quite clear whether the second or the third one is actually a true statement. So, special grammar or just the same? And let's look at some more differences, and maybe we can come back to the question which of those are more likely to be true, or is more likely to be true. In fact, what many people claim is that this isn't so much about black and white, but this is more about which is more likely or less likely in spoken or written language. And in that sense, it's very similar to the differences that we saw in, let's say, legal language and journalistic prose. Yeah, it's a big house, 6 bedrooms. Or living in a big, dirty communal house, eating rubbish. Which one is spoken language? Who's in favor of A? Okay. Who's in favor of B? No one? Okay. Well, the point is that both are possible. I don't know whether this is actually spoken language, but I fully agree with you, it's more likely to be spoken language. For various reasons. The contraction, for example. Also, the pre-modification, big, dirty communal house, eating rubbish. Okay. It's much more likely to be written because it's more dense. But it is possible in spoken English to produce a sentence like the one in B. So really, when we're talking about differences between text types, we shouldn't talk about black and white, or it's always the case that X or Y in different text types, but we're talking about different probabilities for a particular construction, for a particular type of noun phrase, for a particular phenomenon to occur in different registers or text types, or whatever you want to call it. Now, in our department, we tend to look at these kind of things using large corpora. And as you know, and I've said this before, there should have been a lecture on corpus linguistics in the last week, but because we had 1 week where there was no lecture, this one was scrapped this semester. But you'll find later on in your studies that you'll be exposed to this approach. And basically, it's a quantitative approach. We'd be counting noun phrases in one text type or in spoken language, and we would be counting noun phrases in the other, and we could then quantify differences that may not be immediately visible by just looking at individual sentences. I'd like to show you a few additional features of spoken language that may not, at first sight, look like standard English, or at least not typical of written language. Maybe you can spot them with me. Is there anything here which you find odd or noticeable? Hello, oh, hello. My husband and I are wanting to go to the Hook of Holland next weekend. Anything that strikes you as being odd? Sorry? Are wanting, yes. Yes, are wanting. Why is this odd?
Because this
word
is not used.
Because this verb is not supposed to be used in the progressive aspect, right? Okay. Why is it used like this?
Are planning,
yes, are wanting. Well, it says here, grammar and interpersonal meanings, Maybe this has to do with a particular situation and with the way, well, this is to someone who provides a service, and maybe this is less direct. So just imagine, want to go. Yeah? It's more polite in that sense. Yeah. So even though this is not typically a verb that is found in the progressive, since we're talking about a conversation between two people, where there are issues of politeness or face threats, etc., we'll be talking more about this when we talk about pragmatics and politeness, then a form which, strictly speaking, is, well, I don't want to say wrong, but at least highly unusual, becomes perfectly acceptable. And that's, well, obviously got to do with grammar because we're using a particular form, but it's also got with other aspects that come into play when we're looking at spoken language. Okay. Another extract. Again, do you find anything noticeable? So all of that, you see, when you devolve power as they did with the divisional structures, just all went off and did their own thing. And unfortunately, we're having to sort of come back from them, from that, and say, well, is that the most cost-effective? Because we've got to cut our costs. Again, anything that strikes you as being non-written. Having, we're having to, well, the having maybe not, but you're in the right order. What about to sort of come back? The sort of in between, right? Well, again, you may be right as well with the having itself. We have to come back, okay? That's true, yes. But in addition to that, we've got this, well, just now I said it's kind of dangerous or something like that. It's this kind of, this is different. It's this kind of feature, right? When I say this kind of feature, then I have a choice of different features, and I mean exactly this one. Yeah? But it's kind of dangerous, or it's, we have to sort of come back. It's very different from this. It hedges, or it expresses an opinion or an attitude or stance on the part of the speaker. What's the result? It makes it more indirect. And again, perhaps for politeness reasons. It's different to say we have to come back, or we're having to sort of come back. Is it wrong? Well, it's unusual. Does it make sense? Yes, perfect. But it's a feature of spoken language, not something that you would write in an essay. Right, slightly longer extract here, but I need this to make a particular point. This is about a speaker. Well, it might be too small. No, you should just about be able to read it, but I'll read it to you anyway. Speaker one is telling a story about how difficult it was to buy his favorite ice cream, called Magnum, in a small provincial English town. Now, is there anything which strikes you as being slightly odd, perhaps, if you think about normal text composition, essays, that you are supposed to be writing? So we're looking in there, and we can't find any Magnums, so we turn around, and he actually interrupts his phone call to say, you know what you're looking for? And we said, have you got any Magnums? And he sort of shook his head in a way as to say, no, you know, we don't get such things. It was a complete rejection. And we sort of took a step back from the thing, and there it was, labeled Magnum. Okay. Don't worry so much about the content. This isn't about ice cream. But what about grammar? Is there anything which is striking here? Anything noticeable? Yeah? Okay, but punctuation in spoken language is problematic anyway. This is a representation of what was going on. So in a way, you could say that in spoken language, you don't need any punctuation at all, because we don't say, that's true, full stop. Right? I mean, of course, we know when there is some unit finished, but units in spoken language tend to be much more, well, much shorter, and they tend to be indicated with prosody rather than with full stops or question marks or something like that. So I wouldn't be worried about that. Yes?
It's constant changing of tenses.
Yes. Okay.
Well,
it's not a constant change of tense, but it's a change at least once in the sense of present versus past tense. Yes? Okay. We're looking, we can't find, we turn, he interrupts, present tense. And then we move to past tense. Why? What does this have to do with what's going on? Does it perhaps have something to do... Well, this is a case of historic present again, right? We're talking about something in the past, but we're still using present tense. Why do these kind of things happen? Well, maybe in this example it's not as clear, but look at this one. So we were in his car. It was just in this lot. And all of a sudden the buzzer sounds. This type of construction tends to, or this type of switch and tense, tends to occur when we have a background setting or something that's described as happening or as being the case as background to an actual fact that is then the important bit that they want to refer to. Now, we're told to keep tenses consistent. If you write this down, then this would be marked by our language teachers as something wrong, perhaps, or at least not text type specific. But in spoken language, we use it all the time. Maybe much more so than you think. Maybe you can listen to conversations and spot tense changes. And they tend to happen at turns where, an incident is being reported against the background of a particular setting. When I went to see it, the guy says to me, very common. And this seems to be something that people use in telling stories. Because it, using grammatical features, marks transitions, marks where the important bits are in a narration. What's the background and what's the important bit that I would like to focus on? Now this is about grammar, it's about spoken language. And it's got to do with variation as well. But there is... this is not anything goes. There is a system behind it. Now, there are two people who've done quite a lot of work on spoken grammar, McCarthy and Carter, and they say that such variation is by no means random or unmotivated, but coincides with important segments of the narrative, where listeners are, as it were, taken in and out of the story world in real time, as though they are participating in the drama themselves. Now again, this is not strictly speaking about grammar proper, but this is making use of the kind of things that we talked about in the first three sessions to characterize, the larger picture of what is spoken language or what is specific about spoken language. The point to be made here, and I continue reading from McCarthy and Carter, the point to be made here about spoken grammar is that a wide range of strategies is available to speakers to create and reinforce relationships, so this is about interpersonal aspects as well, to involve or detach their listeners, and that the verb phrase morphology plays a key role in signaling these functions. Probably something that you hadn't thought of before, but in order to be able to describe what's going on, you of course need to know the kind of categories that we introduced in the last three lectures. This was about the verb phrase and tenses, but there are differences in spoken and written languages also with respect to where in the sentence particular items occur. What about things like this? Spanish is more widely used, isn't it, outside of Europe? I was worried I was going to lose it, and I did, almost. You know which one I mean, probably? before a speaker was talking about his job. It's a bit panicky, but I've not got any deadlines like you have, though. Again, there is something here which is perhaps not strictly speaking wrong, but clearly not written. And it's got to do with the position of some of the elements, and they tend to come at the end. Right? Spanish is more widely used outside of Europe, isn't it? I was worried I was going to lose it, and I almost did. I did almost is odd. Again, you would be, this would be marked as wrong by our language teachers, because the placement of almost is not as it should be. Again, these are authentic examples, and they're there for a reason. Why does this happen? Well, again, I think the real-time constraints play a role. But another thing happens. If I say, I was worried I was going to lose it, and I did, almost, then the almost receives a particular stress. There's something that's called topicalization. This is about marking what is important in the text. And we seem to be able in English to, and in German as well, to be more flexible about the grammatical rules that are in place if we want to highlight exactly those kind of things. A few more examples. Paul, in this job that he's got now, when he goes into his office, he's never quite sure where he's going to be sent. That's odd. A friend of mine, his uncle had a taxi firm when he had the wedding. Or, his cousin in Beckles, her boyfriend, his parents bought him a Ford Escort for his birthday. Can you make sense of this sentence? I mean, typically, an American, you shake hands with an American, tell them your name, and immediately they'll start using it. Or, well, this little story I was going to tell you about, I was on holiday with an elderly friend of mine in Butlins, Barry Island, South Wales, as you know, and she asked me. Again, if I read them, they sound slightly odd, I would expect, you know? And it's got to do with the ordering of elements. Paul, when he goes into the office, he is. It's the ordering and the repetition, which is odd. His cousin in Beckles, her boyfriend, his parents. What's going on here? Again, you would need to listen to this. Also, a friend of mine, his uncle, it's basically two subjects, right? And it's the same subject. Very odd. But again, this has got to do with putting focus on individual points at a time and in helping listeners to understand what you want to focus on. This is largely wrong in terms of standard English, but it's absolutely okay in terms of spoken language. And he's quite a comic, the fellow, you know. Or talking about shingles, the disease. It can leave you feeling very weak. It can, though, apparently, shingles, can't it? This is interesting because he's quite a comic, the fellow, is very different from what we usually find. Usually we would find the fellow is quite a comic, isn't he? Or we would find shingles can leave you feeling very weak, can't it? We typically have a noun phrase, a full noun phrase, introducing a new item, and then we refer to it with a preposition, with a pronoun. That's not the case here. So the noun phrase content is left until the end. Why does this happen? Well, again, McCarthy and Carthor have a good explanation for this. Such, and the technical term is right dislocated. Okay, it's like sort of taking something and putting it to the right of the sentence. Such right dislocated elements tend to have a strong evaluative function, whether it's good or bad or important or not so important, and usually occur in contexts where speakers are expressing judgments, opinion, stance, etc. He's quite a comic, the fellow. Says something about the attitude that the speaker has about the fellow, or the person that he's talking about. Again, structure in spoken language can be explained by more than just grammar. Of course, you also, and we saw this briefly in the description of the rainbow, you can also have disfluencies and anomalies, or let's call them errors. What's the error here? His teeth were slow coming down, which, fair enough, that was just one of those things. Which and that refer to the same thing. It's like a repetition of a subject, a reduplication of a subject. Very clearly wrong. Again, if you listen to it, it would sound perfectly normal to you. It should fit there, because it's not that big, I don't think. It's not that big, I don't think. So what is it, big or not? Some kind of double negation, which is not supposed to be acceptable in English. Again, very common, and strictly speaking wrong, but it's an effect of what's going on in spoken language. Now, to summarize what McCarthy and Carthor say, I have a fairly longish quote, but I think they're saying it in a very nice, not very good way. The important criterion here for a spoken grammar, so the question is it a spoken grammar or is it not? For a spoken grammar is that irregularities and anomalies that may go against the grammarian's instincts concerning correctness or acceptability should first be checked as to their distribution across speakers and contexts, and where a sufficient number of examples from different speakers in different contexts suggest that a feature is normal and widespread, then it should be entered in the grammar, even though it may still be deemed unacceptable in more formal contexts or in writing. So basically their approach is, there are some aspects that are specific to spoken grammar, and what looks wrong isn't wrong, it's just right in spoken grammar. So largely speaking, we're talking about the same thing, but there is more to that. Spoken and written language differ for various reasons. Spoken grammar status is debated, but I think on the basis of what we've seen, it makes sense that we can postulate some aspects of spoken grammar. But most of the differences, or many of the differences, are probabilistic in the sense that you're more likely to find them in spoken grammar than that they are categorical, that you can only find them in written or in spoken language. Now, if we think about some of the aspects that we've seen, then really we need to rethink grammar in the sense of sentence grammar, because what's more important is now where we go beyond the sentence as spoken language and the larger text, where we want to stress something, what is the topic, etc. So we'll need to talk about this when we get back to aspects like this in the lecture in 2 weeks' time, well, not actually 2 weeks' time, but two lectures' time, when we talk about text linguistics. So these differences and anomalies are likely to be motivated by why they are being used in the spoken language context, so language in use. And the point that I made before is that frequencies are the key here in pointing out these differences rather than clear-cut categories. And we can see whether, if it happens frequently, that this cannot simply be an error, but there is a system behind it. Okay, back to the old layout, and I'll give you a minute to breathe. Okay, so a few seconds to brace yourself for the last 25 minutes or so. Ah, some people think that it's time to leave. Yes. Well, Merry Christmas to you then. And the others who are staying will hear something about variation in grammar and social dialects. Okay. I think we're not going to use the full 30 minutes, so we'll see. It is Christmas after all. So. I still need to go and buy a Christmas tree. But maybe not today. Okay, welcome back. Shall we start? Okay, last few slides. As I said before, the last few lectures were concerned with things like tense and aspect, etc. So and all of this was basically done against the background of standard English. I basically showed you what's in the grammar books in standard English. But of course we also have dialects. We have them in Germany, and there are lots of dialects on the British Isles, and they're very noticeable both in pronunciation, but also with respect to grammatical features. And some of these features may be very distinctive. They might be completely different from what we would find in standard English. So, for example, there are many dialects on the British Isles where we have were instead of was pretty much throughout the whole system. So there's just no was. Okay. Father were very tired when he got home. And that's not wrong, but it's fully correct in this particular dialect, which is non-standard, but it is systematic in the sense that wherever there would be was in standard English, we find were in that dialect. And it just so happens that one is standard and the other one isn't. But in both, we find a system. Yes, very common in many of these dialects. What we typically find in standard English is, I was sitting outside the building when he arrived. And I've already colored this blue because, well, this is a progressive. Past tense or present tense? Well, past progressive because it's the past of the verb be, and therefore, plus the present participle, and therefore it's past progressive. That's what I introduced last week. In many dialects, and in many areas of England, you will see I was sat outside the building when he was arrived. When he arrived. This is strictly speaking wrong. In fact, I saw it in the BBC News, on BBC Online, and I was wondering, it probably was, I don't think it was actually, I think it was intentional. Because you don't find this in written language typically. was a few days ago. So we've got the past tense form of be plus the past participle rather than the present participle. I was sat. So it's a different spectral and tense system that you find in these dialects. And again, there's a system behind this. I introduced relative clauses last time. Restrictive relative clauses, etc. This is a restrictive relative clause because it is only one man of the large population of possible men. I can also delete the relativizer, omit it. This is the man I love rather than who or that I love. And this is something which I said is very common of spoken language. So it's possible to leave out the relative pronoun. All of this is not new. And all of this is standard English. But we also say, we also see examples as the following. And this was said to me in a car by my Australian brother-in-law. I think that's the correct kinship term. Yes. My sister's husband. My wife's sister's husband. Anyway, it's not. It's only your grandfather lives there. Oh. What's odd here? Is this grammatically correct and acceptable? Why not? Who lives there? Yes, so it's only your grandfather who lives there. Why is this one not acceptable? Yeah? Okay, this has got to do with the distinction between subject and object, exactly. And now that you, of course, not, well, you knew this before, but now that you know things about subjects and objects, etc., this is very easy to describe. If you look at the sentence, this is the man I love, you can ask the question what kind of verb it is. It's a transitive verb in the sense that it requires an object, and of course someone who does the loving. Subject is I. What's the object in this is the man I love? The man, right? This is the man who I love, the man, basically, right? So the object of love is the man. And that's why we can leave it out. Let's look at, so it's only your grandfather lives there. Or I think David Lodge has somewhere in one of his novels, I have a woman does my house cleaning. Same thing. What's the subject of live? Who does the living? Well, your grandfather. So the relative pronoun doesn't replace the object, but replaces the subject of the subordinate clause, of the relative clause. So it's only your grandfather who lives there. And that's why this bit up here is called a zero subject relative clause. And zero subject relative clauses are supposed to be illegal in English. They're not. Well, they're supposed to be illegal from a prescriptive point of view, but many people use them. If you look at a large collection of spoken data, you'll find quite a few of them. And not even necessarily by dialect speakers, but by educated speakers. The brother of my wife's sister, now I got it, is a highly educated man, but he still said something which is non-standard. There are also different types of relativization. This is the norm, the standard. This is the woman who taught us. In some dialects, in some non-standard dialects, it's possible to say, this is the woman which taught us. Of course, this will get you into trouble if you write it down, but this is perfectly normal, again, in a particular set of dialects. It's also historically possible. If you go back 1,000 years, then that's also fine. You find other relativizers. This is the woman as taught us, or at taught us, or even what taught us. Relative pronoun what is one of the worst mistakes you can make as a speaker of German. Yeah? But it's perfectly okay if you're a dialectal speaker of certain areas in Britain. Yeah? But don't do it when you write essays for me in linguistics. It's one of the errors that I react most strongly to. Okay. But it's perfectly okay as a non-standard feature in some dialects. So that shows that the relative pronoun system, as the, for example, verbal system, can be very different. And again, the point to be made is it's something that's systematic. So when they say what taught us, then they will always or repeatedly say that, and it's not an error. And then, of course, we have variation between different varieties or different regional dialects. The most obvious one, British, being British versus American English, of course. There are lots of them, of course, in pronunciation and lexis. And people typically say there isn't much between British and American English in terms of grammar, but that's not quite true. There are quite a few differences. For example, in the use of some articles. In American English, it's more likely that you encounter Fred is in the hospital, while in British English, you'd see Fred is in hospital. Or, and Mexico wins against New Zealand in American English versus Mexico win against New Zealand. So this is a question about concord or agreement, where the subject and the verb tend to agree differently. In the British English version, you see Mexico as a group of players, and therefore it's plural. In the American version, it's the team as a whole, which is one entity, and therefore it's singular. Again, this is not 100% black and white, but these are the tendencies that you find. So it's more often to have singular S, third person S, in American English. Do you want to help me set the table in American English? Do you want to help me to set the table in British English? Again, not 100%. But more likely. This is real good. He sure wouldn't do that. The use of adverbs without ly. Something that tends to be American. And there are differences in prepositions. I haven't seen him in years rather than 4 years in British English. Or students protest the war or against the war in British English, under the circumstances in American English versus in the circumstances. These are, of course, not major differences, but these are grammatical differences. They're grammatical because they're using different features that relate to the closed class items. And there are many more, and it would be tedious to go through all of this. Okay, we've now looked at various types of grammar variation in spoken and written, in different text types, in different dialects, in different varieties, regional dialects. And I'd like to finish with a few words on word order. Now, with word order, I don't mean this word in front of the next word, but I refer to something as slightly more abstract. Basically, it's phrase order that we're talking about, as you'll see in a minute. For example, in a sentence like Sebastian likes syntax trees, or I gave her a book, or the girl stumbled, which is a sentence that you've seen before, or winter is a wonderful season. We can say something about the order in which the elements of this sentence or these sentences occur. And we can say that the first sentence is SVO. Subject, verb, object. What's the second one? S-V-O-O, because it's a direct and an indirect object, because give is a ditransitive verb. The third one is just S-V. Winter is a wonderful season is actually a special thing because we've got a linking verb is, and a wonderful season is basically the same as winter. So some people call this a subject complement. So word order refers to the order of the participants, which can be phrases or clauses. And as you can see in all of these sentences, S always comes first. And the next thing is V. And that's because English is a so-called SVO language. If there is an O, then it's last. Some sentences, as you can see, do not have O's. But it's always SV. Well, maybe not quite always, because, of course, we know that in questions, things start to be moved around. Is winter a wonderful season? Where we suddenly have the verb at the beginning. Okay. So question syntax requires a change in word order. So in a way, this becomes VS and then a subject complement. But that's just because it's something completely different. Typically, we're talking about declarative sentences when we're talking about sentence or word order. Notice also in English we have something that is different from what we have in German. Does Sebastian like syntax tree? In some of the questions we have what's known as do support. This dummy do or this auxiliary verb do helps in question syntax. But there are other reasons for different word orders. Potatoes I like, but chips I can't stand. I like potatoes would be the norm. Potatoes I like is a fronting of the object. So we really have OSV here, which is very different. Why? Well, because we are contrasting potatoes and chips. We'll come back to things like that when we talk about text linguistics. Then came the turning point of the match. We have inversion after some adverbs, and that's what you have to specifically learn as language learners of English as a second language. In the town where I was born lived a man who sailed to sea. Some of you might recognize that. Or over the horizon lies a magical kingdom. We have inversion again after a particular preposition phrase of location. Or, Andrew exclaimed what? Well, it's a lie, exclaimed Andrew. We have inversion after quoted speech. So there are good reasons to change word order. Another good reason is shown here. And I'm getting to the end of my lecture. Almost. There's still the goodies. To draw a syntax tree in the middle of the night is fun. A really odd sentence, I have to admit. Is this the most natural way to say this? And can the three people chatting in the back either shut up or leave, please? Because it really is the last 10 minutes. Thank you. Because I can hear it up down here, and I'm sure everyone else can hear it and is either bothered about it or... Well, anyway. Is this the most natural way to say this? Is there a better way to say this? Maybe you would like to contribute to that and say what a better way of saying this is. Come on. Sorry? It's fronted. Ah, it's fun. Sorry. It's fun. Okay. Yes, I wasn't looking for you. I was actually looking for some contributions from the back. But it's fine. Yes, you're absolutely right. It is fun to draw a syntax tree in the middle of the night. Why? Why is this better? Well, because the subject here, what's the subject? To draw a syntax tree in the middle of the night is the subject. It's very heavy, very long. Subject is too heavy. If you replace it with a dummy it, or a reigning it, as it's called, it is fun to draw, then it becomes much more light and much more easy to do. So, it extra position, which is the technical term for this, moves the subject to the back. So again, a change in word order, that can be explained. But the general claim is true, English is a subject, verb, object language. And what's special about this email here, this extract, did our sister research center, did the same old talk, etc. Well, it already says on the slide the subject is missing. Is this usually allowed in English? Well, it seems to be possible, again, this is a register-specific feature, in email or in informal contexts. If you compare it to other languages, well, the norm would be I speak English. Ich spreche Englisch. You require the ich, the subject. Je parle anglais. You require the je. But in Italian, it's perfectly okay to say parlo inglese or hablo inglés or something like that, however you pronounce that. Okay? Or gavariu paruski, where there is no ja gavariu paruski. So in Italian, Spanish, and Russian, it's possible to have a null subject. So, even though the word order might be there as a sort of general structure, it's possible to leave out aspects, like the subject in some languages, which tends not to be possible in English. Word order in German is also something quite interesting. If I say, ich lebe in Trier, this is basically, I live in Trier, which is the same structure. Verb is in the second slot, and I'm sure you know that German is a verb second language. Vor drei Jahren, it's actually not true, vor fünf Jahren lebte ich in Lancaster. 3 years ago lived I in Lancaster. No, it doesn't work in English. So German is a V2 language. The verb is always second. And that's a rule that doesn't exist in English. So there is of course variation on a much sort of larger or more general scale when we look at different types of languages and the way they make use of the kind of structures that are available. But this is becoming rather complex. Now, final bit of syntactic fun. Not sure whether you'll find it fun. But it's just a few things to show you, just two things actually, to show you that there are some really interesting things about syntax that one could look at if you're going to look more into this. Compare the two sentences, I asked him what to wear, and I told him what to wear. What's the difference, apart from asked and told? Both are ditransitive. Yes.
That first sentence is a request. So because when I ask someone, it's a request that he to do something, and the second one is like a command because he said he has.
Clearly the second one I told that he has to. Okay, but I'm not sure it's the actual sort of request versus command, that this would be also not grammatical as such, but this is more like a pragmatic difference. But there is something interesting about, or something different, beyond just the two verbs. Both are ditransitive verbs. What is what to wear? Well, a subordinate clause. What's the object in the subordinate clause? To wear what? Okay. What's the subject in the subordinate clause? Who is the subject of what to wear? I asked him what I should wear. Yeah? I told him what he, yes. Why? Yeah, same structure in a way, but it's a completely different subject that's involved. I find that interesting how that works, because in the structure itself, you can't really see this. And this hasn't got anything to do with the verbs asked and told as such, does it? Because structurally, both are the same. Or, I like syntax trees. You've seen that, okay? I don't like syntax trees might be your reaction, okay? And the difference is the little bit here, the negation. Not negates the verb, or in this case, the auxiliary. What about sentences like this? It doesn't seem that we can get our money back. I don't imagine he'll come. I don't think this is fair. Can you rephrase this? Can you say what's actually going on here? I don't imagine he'll come. What does that mean? Does he mean that he comes and joins them? No, right? It means that he doesn't. But what is actually negated? The imagining, and the thinking, and the seeming. But what is actually semantically negated? This bit, and that he'll come, and that this is fair. I don't think this is fair. Is it fair or not? No, it isn't. I don't think? Well, of course I think. So, it seems that the negative element of the subclause is raised in the hierarchy to the verb of the main clause. Why? I find that interesting. Okay. So, conclusion. In the last four lectures, you got lots of things about words, phrases, clauses, and sentences. The four elements of the rank scale. The point that I made repeatedly was that hierarchy is important. That trees can show this. And in the final lecture, I talked about variation and word order. And I tried to make two interesting additional points, and there are about 200 others that could be mentioned. So there's much more fun out there. But enough of syntax. Yeah. Next time, in the next lecture, we'll be dealing with semantics. And I'll finish with two Calvin and Hobbes cartoons which have to do with semantics in some way. Safari owl hacks his way through the jungle. Suddenly a giant gorilla rips through the foliage. Clean your room. What? You hurt me. It's a jungle in here. What's the meaning of the word jungle? Or, a bushel is a unit of weight equal to 4 pecks. What's a peck? A quick smooch. Sort of a quick kiss. You know, I don't understand maths at all. Well, the word peck seems to be the problem here. The problem has to do with meaning, with different meanings, with syntax. No, sorry, I'm so insane. With semantics. Enough syntax for now. And see you next year. And Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.